Last week, I spoke to S&C coach Jamie Scott on how to improve your hybrid performance. Have you got a hybrid challenge coming up? Well, you better check out that episode for recommendations you can use now for your training. Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we're joined by sports physiologist, Dr. Becky Neal. Now, have you ever done an obstacle course race such as Spartan or a Tough Mudder? Now, think about doing one of those, but at Everest Base Camp. That's exactly what Dr. Becky Neal has done. And not only that, she did it as part of a massive research study. So in this episode, we're going to be discussing her experiences in the Himalaya and also how her research is helping us understand how people function in high altitude. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram, YouTube, and check out all of our other content. Here is Dr. Becky Neal. Before we get started, I wanted to mention the Progress Theory newsletter. Do you want the latest information on how to optimize human physical and mental performance sent straight to your email? Subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack, where you will receive the latest research and recommendations on how to optimize your performance each week. Head to the show notes and click the link where you can sign up today. Don't miss out. Now, let's get into the show. Becky, thank you so much for coming back on The Progress Theory.
Good to be here. Thank you, Phil.
How's it been since we last spoke? I know we said hello, I think, at a few high rocks, but last time we proper catched up was on the episode. But what's been going on since then?
Yeah, a lot, I guess. I've been doing more environmental physiology research, been doing more sport, been doing more stuff to help develop the sport as well for obstacle course racing. So really it's been kind of hectic, but I love all of the stuff I do, so that helps. But yeah, lots of trips abroad, including one pretty special one that we're going to spend some time talking about.
Exactly. This whole series wants to be focused towards on, you know, how to perform in like particular events or challenges. And what I like about it, it's going to cover like more the common ones like Math and Desarb and stuff like that. But at the same time, there's new challenges coming about being created all the time. And that's exactly what you've done, especially in the world of obstacle course racing. So for the listeners, you created the world's highest obstacle course race and did it as part of a research study. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah. So, I've been involved with a few different kind of adventure tourism, I suppose, is what we might class it as, events. In the past, I've prepared people for Marathon des Alpes because my PhD is in heat acclimation. So I've done a bit of work in that in years gone by. Lots of kind of useful things, tips around that area, which we've talked about before. This event in Nepal at Mount Everest, near base camp, in fact, at pretty high altitude. We can talk about that. It was an event called World's Highest OCR, put on by a company, actually, they're from the UK, but involved people from 14 countries around the world, and had three stages to it. So there was the trek, the kind of traditional base camp trek from a place called Lukla up to Everest Base Camp. And then that's kind of where it really began. That bit was challenging. But then we did an obstacle course race at near there, Gorup Sherpa, up to Kala Patal, which is the summit just next to, just a bit higher than Base Camp, in fact. And that was the second kind of stage to it. And that continued into the ultra run, the ultra marathon running back down to Namche Bazaar, which was, you know, just over marathon distance. So it was a pretty big event, pretty challenging. I think there was about 37 participants from 14 different countries.
Including yourself,
in addition to that, I did take part as well. But my main reason for being there was to kind of observe and measure what was going on with these people, monitor their physiological and cognitive responses to the high altitude, but also like the whole event itself, because everything is very integrated. It's not just the altitude that's having an impact on your body and your mind. It's more than that. So I really wanted to see how in that scenario, which more and more people are doing, being exposed to, what's really going on and what can we do going forwards to help protect people, prevent kind of more emergency situations and make sure everyone has a good time, really.
Yes, I've done the Everest Base Camp trek. My wife and I did it a few years ago now. But so I recognised the names of the places that you were saying. So, and I've also climbed Kala Patal. So I know exactly where the sort of obstacle course bit took place, which, to be honest, because the way the mountain, I guess a mountain is set up, you know, it's very winding and you're kind of climbing it or very much scrambling it. So it almost feels like an obstacle course on its own, but you added in different obstacles to that.
Yes, there were 10 sort of man-made obstacles. And if you think about, you know, how remote that was when you visited that, you know, you're 12 days, 60-something kilometres away from the nearest road. You know, you can't just get there unless you've got a helicopter. That's probably not a good idea either. You can't just turn up there. So getting the obstacles there was actually a journey in itself. You know, the event organisers spent months doing that, you know, on a boat around halfway around the world, then on trucks, and then people essentially carrying it off the helicopter, taking it to such a high level. So, you know, employing loads of the local people to kind of help with that. But yeah, there's 10 obstacles with, you know, some structures that were built, but also I would say probably the hardest carry I've ever done, you know, weighted carry, because that was at the top of Kalpatar. So Kalpatar is 5,600-ish metres. So at that level, you've got half the amount of oxygen as normal, like proportionally. That's a lot harder to breathe. And it was 20 kilograms, which doesn't sound very heavy. But when you're walking on those big scrambly rocks, if you remember, from the top of that kind of summit there, you know, you can barely get your footing carrying nothing. So having a kind of pile of rocks on your shoulder with half the amount of oxygen, it was 6 a.m. and minus 20 degrees. That was, I would say, the hardest carry I've ever done, and I've done like 6 years of obstacle course racing and a few high rocks, like you say.
How did that feel? Because obviously when you're running with the heavy carry, I mean, it depends how you're carrying it, but say you carried it in front of you know, it's pressing against your torso, which if you're doing it at sea level, you can feel the sort of oxygen strain, as in you're like breathing strain that provides. Yeah. Is that just magnified 10 times when you've got half the oxygen available?
Yeah, I mean, you're already going up. It was a very steep hill. You know, Kalpatar is, I think you gain about 400 metres of elevation in probably less than a mile of sort of distance. So it's very steep. And that, you're already hyperventilating, basically, because you know, you have to increase your breathing rate. So I carried it on my shoulder, but, you know, I was going very, very slowly. Very slowly because of the terrain, you know. One, because I'm very conscious, you know, of hurting myself. Because in that scenario, even if you just roll an ankle, everything is more kind of, there's bigger consequences, right? It would have consequences for me personally, but also, like, you're in the middle of nowhere. There's not an easy way out. You need to, like, get to a different place. So I was being very cautious as well. So I carried it on my shoulder, but very slowly and carefully over those big kind of boulders. But yeah, the other obstacles I thought were relatively easy in comparison. So there was like a 8-foot wall, a 10-foot wall as well, I think. Some 4-foot walls on the way up. And then a balance obstacle, like a cargo net obstacle, monkey bars, like a rope swing kind of obstacle. And then quite like a finger grippy kind of transition kind of obstacle. So hanging just off your fingertips, moving from like rock climbing holds sideways, it's like suspended. And then the final obstacle was a ramp, a wall, like you might see at the end of Ninja Warrior. And I've done quite a few of those. I've been on Ninja Warrior twice, and there's a lot of obstacle course races that end in it. The highest ones in obstacle course races are like in Toughest, which is 4.2 or 4.5 meters. And they actually did this race last year, or the year before, in Kilimanjaro, which I believe you also summited. And that was 4 metres when they did it there. They decided to make it harder this year, and it was 5 metres.
Wow.
I don't know if you've ever seen it. Like, I've never seen a 5-metre wall at any race. There's a 19-foot wall in American Ninja Warrior, but it was massive. And I don't think it would be achievable at sea level.
Yeah.
So there were certain rules involved with the obstacle course race. You know, you had 3 attempts at the obstacle, and if you didn't do it, you get a 10-minute time penalty, and you had to meet a minimum number in order to be a finisher. So, you know, we got there the day before to Gorokshep, which is just before Everest Base Camp, which is kind of like, if you remember, like the moonlandy looking bit.
Very dry.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole area is quite dry, but I just remember it almost being quite barren, that area, but a few...
Yeah.
I guess hostels for setting people up to go a bit further to the base camp and to go up Kalpatar. But yeah, I remember Gorokshep quite well, because that was the only place where when I was sleeping, I kept waking up going like that, like I was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, like trying to get air, whereas I was completely fine everywhere else. But Yeah.
I mean, I'm impressed you got to sleep. I couldn't sleep at all.
Could you not? No,
I got 0 hours before this race.
I got to sleep. I was normally okay, but I just really remember just that waking up thinking like that, just trying to gasp for air, and then I was fine and then fell back asleep. But it happened a few times, but it didn't happen anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I had acute mountain sickness there, the night before when we arrived. Oh. And when we pushed to base camp and then stayed at Goropshep. I didn't want to eat. I had a headache, you know, all the classic AMS signs. And I actually got quite emotional as well. And I didn't really feel like that at any other point. You know, maybe it was kind of everything put together, especially with the research work I was doing as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely felt different there. And it was not clean. I couldn't sleep. It was really, really cold. And there was a lot going on. Mm. But yeah, the 5 meter wall at the end was a big challenge. We got there and I was speaking to the head of World Obstacle about it. And I was saying, this is not achievable. They got somebody to have a go at it, but not like Liz, not the participants.
So no one completed that obstacle?
They actually attached a rope, like a tiny, found a random bit of rope, anything that they could find in a really remote place, and dangled it from the top. So it came down about a meter or so. So you could run and catch the rope, which was really springy, and then have to pull yourself over the top. So that, obviously that's still a challenge. And in fact, only 4 or 5 of us did it, I think. So I did do it. Yeah, I did overcome the obstacle, the 5 meter wall in the end. I was very pleased with that.
Did you win? Did you win the obstacle course race?
I didn't win because the obstacle course race ended after the ultra.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
So I didn't win overall, no. But I completed the most obstacles. The best. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Not all the other women did.
Sounds like the Tour de France. You've got stage wins. You won the...
Yeah.
You won
the OCR stage.
OCR stage, yeah. But I mean, I've done that toughest wall, is it 4.2, did you say? That's much harder than any of the other ones that I've seen at like a Tough Mudder or a Spartan.
And that's got a nice run in, because you run on the ramp for a while. This one was on like the earth at like Everest Base Camp is like dusty. It's like sand. So you can't get much. And it was like wooden slats.
Wow.
And the top bit was vertical, so it was hard.
Yeah.
But yeah.
How did you find the temperature? Because I know you said it was minus 20 because you were doing it early. And when Hayley and I climbed Kalapathar, we did it deliberately because they said that you get a better view of the peak of Everest at the top of Kalapathar rather than at Everest Base Camp. So I remember it being very cold on the way up, particularly cold. But I also remember as soon as the sun came over the mountains, just this heat just came onto us. So it's a real big sort of night and day, you know, the temperature changed within seconds. So by the time you're coming down, you're just like taking clothes off because you're just dripping with sweat.
Yeah, definitely. And I was actually like, I was just begging, I was waiting for it to hit. Like I kept looking behind me going up the summit, like thinking, when is the sun going to hit? When is the sun going to hit? And like I had big gloves on, but like we'd been like, you know, you don't necessarily want big gloves on if you're going to do a very finger grippy obstacle. So I had like different gloves in my pockets and stuff. But yeah, it definitely felt very cold. But you know, obviously you generate a lot of heat when you're going up a big hill as well. But yeah, it was instantly different as soon as the sun hit. And it was in the sun when I got to the summit. So I took a couple of minutes to sit there and kind of soak it up a bit before running down.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Yeah, that sunrise is amazing. The view's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
From the top of there.
Yeah. But getting out of bed for that race was really hot.
I bet.
Not that I was having any sleep, but it was so cold getting out of
bed. You didn't
bed.
Wake up
There's
for
no
it, did
light.
You? You
yeah. Yeah. Sleep deprivation is definitely a strong theme.
It's a weird feeling, isn't it? Because I had some sleep deprivation when Hayley and I first did Mount Elbrus. We weren't uber high. I think it was around 3,800 at the time, but because we went from quite low to high, it was just that sudden challenge.
Fast.
Actually, yeah. And also, I think we retired, so we slept during the day. And then when we went to sleep in the evening, it was just like... But there's this weird sort of feeling over you. It isn't just that you're awake. I feel like you're awake, but there's a sort of like weird feeling over you when you notice the altitude around you.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes it worse. Well, certainly harder to sleep or concentrate on sleeping.
I was very aware that what I was about to do the next day was going to probably be the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. And I was already the most exhausted I'd ever been. And I thought, this is ridiculous. How can I possibly do this? Like, I'd been sad, like, because I thought, like, I want to perform really well. Like, I am a competitive athlete. I want to do well. And I had all these extra kind of stresses of getting the equipment to work for the research study. You know, we had these cool new devices which continuously monitor oxygen saturation on the ear in a better way than the wrist wearables that do it kind of intermittently, or finger ones. So I've been kind of trying to get all that organized. And we've got, like, the world championships as well. And, everything was kind of weighing on me at that point, and it was tough.
Yeah, I can imagine it. A lot on the mind, physically, both physically and emotionally. Yeah. With the obstacle course, I mean, obviously it's a race, so you want to move as fast as possible, but at the same time, you can't move too fast, because moving too fast and moving that high altitude in a short space of time, because it's so steep, is really quite dangerous. And if you're already feeling the effects of high altitude sickness, you know, that could have really exacerbated that. So yeah, how did you take the speed of it? Because I remember when going up, you're kind of going at the speed of step, step, step. It's really slow, but I wasn't racing. So how did you take that?
It's difficult to know for sure, and you're doing it based on perception. You know, I'm a scientist, I'm like to monitor a lot of things. I had a glucose monitor on, I had oxygen saturation monitors on, I had my heart rate. So I had all of that information that usually you kind of integrate all that in your brain and then decide how you feel and then base it off of that. But like I said, I was very aware of not hurting myself, because that would ruin, you know, my sports stuff, and it would also ruin my research and the whole kind of purpose of me being there. So I was more cautious and more slow because of that. Also, so the run down, like the obstacles, I was more confident on because they felt relatively easy, and I didn't really feel like the altitude had much impact on them because they were quite short in nature of the obstacle. But the run down definitely was where all the time was kind of lost or made. So it was, yeah, like 46 or 48 kilometers about a month before. I'd done a marathon in like 3:15, but this took me over 12 hours.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can't compare it. You can't, you know, you probably remember from your trek there, but like on the signs, it says how many hours it is to something, how many hours of walk, not how much distance it is, because time works differently. You know, you can't climb as fast as you run. You know, maybe a couple of people in the world can do that, but yeah, everything's longer. But also, so the run down went from basically the top of Kaltar, which was like 5,600, down to Namche Bazaar, big town near the bottom of the route, which is at like 3,200. So you're losing a couple of thousand meters of elevation. It's a long run down, but there's also, to get the kind of the route in, they designed a route that shot off to the side a bit up to a place called Chukung, and that had a lot of climbing as well. So there was actually still like nearly 2,000 meters of climbing in the downhill run, and that slowed me down a lot. They had cutoff times as well, and I was like an hour and a half ahead of the cutoff time at some points, and then at the end it was 5 minutes, and then I was cut off and I had to sleep on my own in a random tea house overnight and by the Tengbeche Monastery with no other stuff. Like, you know, because we were fortunate, we had some yaks or cows to carry our big bags, like our duffel bags, and just had day sacks. So for that night, I was not with anybody else from the event, apart from a support Sherpa called Karma Sherpa. He was kind of helping me out at that point.
Did he go with you the whole marathon down?
No, so we all ran on our own. There were people who took part in the event who were trekkers, so they trekked down as a group and they didn't do the full distance. So then there were the runners, the people competing in the championships, and we ran individually, following flags, following our watch GPS. But then at the point where I missed the cutoff, there was a couple of the Sherpas that were supporting the event who basically came and picked up the flags, like took down the course. And as I was like last at that point, everyone else had already been cut off. So a lot of people didn't finish it, but I was kind of last at that point, but fourth. but everyone else hadn't made the earlier cutoffs.
You see, earlier you said there was 23 people competing, or was it in the 30s?
I think, So there's like 30 something, but some, quite a few people did the obstacle course part, but then trekked down together. Yeah. And some people were going to run and then changed to trekking because of the challenge. The difficulty was too much.
Wow.
So actually only about 10 or 11 people completed the whole thing. So I completed the whole course. I got to the end, but I was a bit slower. I was the last person to finish the race. I think I was like a 11th, but I was like the fourth woman. That was it. Yeah, the rest were men.
Well, it's still incredibly impressive. Yeah. What was the level of the athletes that were doing the run? Were they all like ultra marathon runners anyway?
They mostly come from obstacle course racing. So the lady who won overall, in fact, Sandy, she's from the Philippines. She's a Spartan racer there. She's on the national team. They've got a very advanced kind of obstacle course program in the Philippines because of the Southeast Asian Games. So she's competed in the 100 meters, but she's good at Spartan racing. She lives in the mountains. She trains in the jungle and in the mountains. So she's pretty strong, but not as technical. And then Yara came second. She's from America. She's I don't know if you know, but she's got the record for the most trifectas in a year. She's done Alvarez. She's done like 33 trifectas like around the world in one calendar year, which is mad. Like there's not that many weekends.
I didn't know that there was that many Spartans going on.
Exactly. Well, she's been all over the world. Mm. So she came second. She wasn't actually very far behind Sandy, but like she does the age group Spartans. So, you know, in a Spartan race, I'd probably beat her or any old kind of obstacle course race, but she was so strong uphill. She got ahead at the start and then was just really great at running kind of the distance. Whereas I'd only done one marathon at that point, and most of my races are like fast, flat, technical obstacle course races. That's my kind of area of OCR. Mm. Yeah, I just couldn't do the hills and the running, really.
That was the limiter. It's the hills that were the limited people. It's quite cool to hear that, you know, you've got really quite an elite group of people there to do a particular task that technically has never been done before, except for something similar in Kilimanjaro, right?
Kilimanjaro.
And only 11 or 12 people actually completed it.
Yeah.
So, it shows her the difficulty of it. Did you really notice the high altitude? As in, like, it really... Obviously, you talked about how you felt at Gorek Shep, but when it came to actually performing at the running, did it really affect you?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely did affect me. Like, I couldn't reach the higher capacities, but I was also limited by the terrain. You know, I couldn't get up to my top, you know, road speed because of the terrain. So that bit that might be would like come off the top of my, you know, VO2 max, I wasn't actually kind of trying to achieve that level. But the fatigue and everything to do with it, you know, it was larger, which meant that, you know, just even just walking parts of it was really, really tough. So I say that, like, I didn't necessarily notice it much. And especially when you've been there for kind of 12 days or so already, you're already kind of adjusted a bit. So just knowing that your breathing is faster. And I checked my oxygen saturation, it's like 81. I'm like, okay, well, that's just how I live now. And if I felt okay, then it was all right. But also carrying like the bag, because, you know, there's quite a few kind of essential items for when you go out on your own in the middle of the Himalayas. So it was quite heavy, and I'm not used to running with that much on my back. So that slowed me down as well. So
it was a rough run, almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I would rather have like a little race pack, but I had an actual rucksack, and I did use everything in it. Well, apart from like the first aid kit, I was fortunately didn't have to use that. But because I ended up staying in this tea house without my stuff, I just had whatever I'd put in my bag for there. And, you know, it was essential. I met some people from New Zealand or somewhere. They charged my Garmin for me in the middle of the race. They got me like some hot tea and stuff. And yeah, so it was an adventure.
Because you normally take your own sleeping bag as well around.
Yeah, so that was somewhere, that was halfway up the mountain, not with me.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I just slept without a sleeping bag.
it gets really cold.
With the same
cold.
Clothes.
Yeah,
I had nothing.
Did you not sleep then either?
No, I could hear the rats scurrying around. I could hear the rats.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I
don't want to put anyone off doing the Everest Base Camp. It's amazing, but I don't remember hearing rats, but I can imagine rats being there.
Yeah, it was like,
I was in one of the lower levels in Tengbushe, of the like tea house. So, you know, I wasn't in a tent, I was in a building. It was nice. It's cold outside of that communal room though. So like when I woke up, I just sort of got up because I was already ready and just sort of went out, carried on running.
That's cool. What I remember most is it was just so cool to, you have a rough plan of where you're going to go next, but you didn't really. If you wanted to carry on, you could, and then you just move to the next town, you find somewhere to stay there. It just felt so free when doing the Everest Base Camp trek. Like wife and I miss it a lot. It was just, it's so cool, isn't it?
It's magical, and the views are amazing, and the people are great,
I'm just going to interrupt here to quickly thank our sponsors. Hydrate by Human24. Hydrate is a fast and effective formula to improve hydration by replacing fluid and body salts after an intense training session or after a long night's sleep. Each sachet contains an optimal ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium to improve cellular hydration. I highly recommend the citrus flavor, which I always take immediately upon waking. It really sets my day up perfectly. Head to human24.com, that's HMN24.com, where you can get a month's supply of 30 sachets and use the code FILL10 at checkout for 10% off. Now, let's get back into the conversation. So what were you trying to find out from performing the world's highest obstacle course race, and what were the findings?
Yeah, so I went to Paris last week to present some of our results from a study that we looked at, trying to understand more about like the physiological, but also the cognitive responses to high altitude, and especially how that works in real life in an applied world when you actually go and do these things. A lot of the work has already been done in labs, you know, to isolate the mechanisms and why things change and how they change and how much they change and who they change in and things like that. So some of those things have already been done. You know, there's a link already between acute mountain sickness and cognitive function, and that's been kind of measured as well on some kind of treks and things. But what we wanted to do is work towards creating some standards, and this company that we did the event with, they're interested in creating world's highest standards.
Cool.
Just to help prevent people getting ill or severely ill, and to make sure that people attending these events, because they're getting more and more accessible, you know, essentially just need to have some money, and in the grand scheme it's not even as expensive as some other kind of big trips or holidays and things. So more and more people are going, and those people are less and less prepared in terms of their physical fitness, but also their experience in terms of high altitude. And you know, it's all very well organized. You know, this event that I went on was probably a bit more kind of established than your trek, because, you know, there was a plan. I didn't have to worry about any single thing. I didn't have to look for a place to stay. I just turned up and did it. So if you have the money, you can go and do that. But you're probably more at risk of some of the things that come along with those things. You know, you're going to be very tired and you might get some altitude illness. So what we wanted to do is monitor those things and see whether there are any other ways that we could detect them earlier, see who was more at risk, whether there was things that we can measure kind of physiologically, or whether there's little simple surveys and things that we can do to see, oh, this person's actually kind of heading towards not being very well, but they're not showing the symptoms of AMS yet, that kind of thing. Especially in some of these kind of larger groups or bucket list kind of trips, a lot of people don't want to admit that they're not very well. And sometimes there's other kind of things that come into place with people who work there and motivators for people to be to get to the summit or to not get to the summit and need a helicopter and, you know, add money to the economy that way. So there's a lot of things going on. So we're kind of looking to see whether there are like certain criteria or monitoring things that we can do to add a bit more information to all those decisions to help people and help expedition leaders or guides make some calls that will be better for everyone else. So the kind of that you need to have, that needs to be evidence-based, right? It's got to be robust so that you can trust that, you know, if someone's going to, because I saw some horrible things, like, you know, even just it's a trek, it's not, you're not summiting Everest, that's a whole other story, but I still saw people like sat on a horse, not able to hold the body upright, not with it at all, definitely unwell, and they're going up the mountain, they're on a horse making it worse, they're going higher. They should not be doing that. Whose decision is that? And like could we have prevented it? Could you adjust, like you said, you could spend another day at a certain village, spend another day acclimatizing. Can you make some of those decisions in order for you to achieve your goals of getting to, you know, Carpatar or something like that? So basically trying to use information and data to kind of make more informed choices to prevent people from getting altitude illness of varying severities. So yeah, measured quite a few different things.
Was there any particular physiological or cognitive marker that stands out in terms of, like, if that's slightly raised before the participant is showing more obvious symptoms? Is there any key precursor that's showing a little bit more at the moment?
So I'll tell you about what we measured. On the trek, we had like 4 different days where we kind of stopped and did these different tests. So we had like a baseline one at Kathmandu before we left, and then one at like 3,300 meters, 4,200 meters, and then 2,800 meters. So we wanted to see like how they changed and how severe the measurements were. So we measured some cognitive tests like reaction time. So very simple reaction time with blaze pods. I don't know if you use them.
I don't think I've used them, no.
I feel like you would like them.
Yeah.
Yeah, little light-up pods that you can put anywhere.
Oh, yeah, I see a lot of F1.
It's like a reaction time.
F1 drivers use them quite a lot.
Yeah. They're really versatile. So it measures your reaction time. It's not just whether you got it, hit it or not. So it actually measures the milliseconds. So we did like a simple one of that and then a more complicated one with like a distraction. So there's different light colours that light up and you have to get the correct one. So that also meant that we could measure how many you got wrong, how many mistakes you made. So it's kind of like a speed versus accuracy trade-off activity. So reaction time, but also some other cognitive function tests, looking at like spatial executive function things. We have like a test called path span where you have to remember the sequence and where things are on an iPad. And then some other ones looking at, working memory, auditory verbal learning tasks. So I asked participants to like remember a list of 15 words, and we looked at how well they learnt those and how well they could remember them and whether the other things interfered with that. So I had a different list of words and we did it delayed as well, so seeing how kind of forgetful they were too. And this other thing, which is provided by NASA, it's an app, it's called the Task Load Index, and it asks you questions about how you perceive, how challenging you perceive the task to be. So like physically, how challenging is it? Mentally, how challenging is it? What's the time pressure? How frustrated are you or fatigued? So you get some scores from that about your kind of perception of the challenge of the task. So they were kind of like the cognitive tests. Then we had other ones as well related to fatigue. So like a survey on fatigue, but also the classic Lake Louise questionnaire for acute mountain sickness, and then also some more kind of physiological measurements. So obviously oxygen saturation, which I mentioned, we got this one on the ear, but also on the finger pulse oximeter, which is going to go down. We also looked at like exertion and sleep as well with some surveys. And then one more really cool thing we did, which was look at optic nerve size, so the nerve behind your eye.
Wow.
That changes with altitude. So that's already been shown in research. It changes with altitude. We think it's related to like the pressure in your brain, in your head. And that might be the link between cognitive function, acute mountain sickness. So we measured that with an ultrasound, a little handheld wireless ultrasound thing that worked with an iPad, which we took all the way from America to Nepal and literally put it on people's eyes whilst we were on the trek. And looked at how many millimeters was the diameter of the sheath that goes around the nerve behind your eye. So pretty technical stuff with that one and some of the physiological measurements. We basically try to see whether any of these correlate with each other, whether they change at the different altitudes. And yeah, we found some things, not all the things were necessarily related, and there's definitely like more work to do. I think probably one of the most interesting things that stood out to us pretty obviously was the reaction time tasks. So people were actually able to maintain their reaction time at the different high altitudes. So there wasn't really any differences there, which is like quite interesting. But what they weren't able to do was make sure they got the correct choice each time. So their errors increased. So they managed to maintain their speed, but their accuracy was awful. The errors went from like 0% to like 30%, which if you extrapolate that to like meaningful decisions at high altitude, making a mistake can cost your life. Like, it is quite an important finding, I'd say. It might be like the group that we were doing it in, these are competitive international athletes competing in a world championships. So maybe they value speed more than other people. Maybe other people wouldn't be so caring so much about the speed, like they're quite competitive people. But I think that is also the nature of people that end up in these kind of adventure tourism environments as well. They're generally more competitive, or they like a challenge. So yeah, the error rate went up significantly, and that was, you know, at high altitude, but it was also more prevalent at when we came back down. So the last test we did on day 12 was at 2,800 meters. So that wasn't our highest point, but that's where we had the highest errors. So it wasn't necessarily the altitude that's making these kind of issues occur. It's more the fatigue. And when we look at our kind of fatigue survey results, that is, it is so strong. And just being there, like, I felt it, like, fatigue takes over everything. You know, I don't really notice my oxygen saturation unless I've got, say, some AMS symptoms, or, you know, I develop pulmonary edema or something. You don't necessarily know you're making wrong decisions, but you feel fatigued, and that informs all of your choices that you make and the mistakes that you make too. That fatigue is so strong in these kind of, you won't really kind of figure that out from some of the lab studies. It's the real kind of applied integratedness of, have you eaten enough? Have you drunk enough? Have you slept enough? Are you socially okay? So I think, like, that was kind of like the most evident thing. There was also a couple of people who didn't succeed and on this kind of expedition that we did. We had a couple of people drop out. So two people stopped lower down, one quite low down, and another one a little bit higher, and they didn't get as high as to the highest point that we were aiming for. And another person who was probably the favorite to win the men's race, he was flown in a helicopter from the start line. Basically, he wasn't allowed to take part in the start. He basically was on his way to pulmonary edema, went straight to hospital. So it's very good that he didn't do the race. He wasn't taking part in the study. But the other two were. So I have the data from the two that were kind of evacuated beforehand, the people less severely. But I have their baseline data and how they were feeling just before they were evacuated, which is really, really interesting. Looking at the NASA results from the task survey, the task load index, it's called, about how difficult they perceived it to be. And I put it on the poster, actually. I did a little case study on the poster, comparing the person who was evacuated at the lowest altitude and how hard they perceived all the things to be compared to the rest of the group of the people I collected data from. And they were way above everybody else. They're on 95 for frustration when everyone else is on 29 out of 100. And they're on 100 on some of the variables, whereas the others were on 57. They're on 80 for physical demand. The others were on 26. So fatigue was on 82 versus 37. So, like, all of these numbers for these kind of parameters are so much higher than everybody else just from doing a little survey. So if I'm an expedition leader, I can do that. It takes a couple of minutes. I can see, oh, this person's kind of, it's harder for them than everyone else. It's harder, or it's changed. It's gone up from when we measured it, when we started. And you can kind of start to pay more attention to that person, see what they need more. Like, do you need to spend another night somewhere? Or, like, what can you do to help? And the interesting thing about that was their AMS scores were the same as everybody else's. So if you were just looking at oxygen saturation and acute matter sickness, you wouldn't know that they were any worse off. But these perception things, which factor into their, like, decisions and how they're feeling, they were clearly not handling it as well as everybody else. And then they didn't succeed. They had to stop. We left them for many, many days lower down. And, you know, that can impact people in the future.
They had to wait lower down for you to go up and then back down.
Exactly, yeah. They missed out. And, like, if you could do any of that beforehand, then maybe you would prevent that person going. But, yeah, you don't really know until you're there. But you could adjust if you're on, like, a small, like you and Haley, like, you can adjust your plan to suit that better, you know, wait there for another day until you've refueled a bit more and then tackle it or something. Or just decide that person shouldn't go any higher, because otherwise you'll be dealing with a more severe evacuation, you know. Quite useful, I think, so far.
Earlier you mentioned that this adventure company is going to be looking to do more events like this. What are future plans, and do they tie into any future plans that you have for research?
Yeah, I mean, we've got lots of ideas. The next event that they have, they've got some high altitude marathons in Kilimanjaro. Then there's a trip to Antarctica in December, if you're interested. Ooh, that's got that a 10K obstacle course race. And I think it's such a shorter event, like a few days in Antarctica. But obviously the travel there is a long way. There is a high altitude mountain there, but it's not part of the obstacle course race. But the difficult thing about that one will be the snowshoes, you know. You can't take your gloves off there to do the obstacle. Mm. So there's going to be different challenges and different people to kind of consider from an environmental physiology point of view. And it's, again, very, very remote. So that will all kind of contribute to the event and people's performances. Then there's a whole series of other events. You know, there's Kilimanjaro again in the future. And I think world's highest OCR will then be at Kilimanjaro, more repetitively. So you can compete every year in the altitude kind of world championships. This race was sanctioned by World Obstacle earlier. So it was like the actual kind of altitude portion of OCR and the kind of the championship event for that. So yeah, there's lots of future kind of things in mind. We've got some ideas about other things to measure, especially kind of looking at different monitoring devices. So the ultrasound equipment that we used, probably going to do some more in that area, but also more with other wearables, some other companies involved with that. And Oxywear, again, a partner with the event. Mm. So we'll be looking at monitoring oxygen saturation continuously. I put it on participants' ear throughout the race and try to collect continuous data there, which is really, really interesting to see, like, because my oxygen saturation was like 81, but somebody else's might have been 90. So over the course of the run, you know, you're exposed to a lot more physiological strain or hypoxic strain if you're consistently lower. So there's lots of interesting things to do, especially kind of the cognitive point of view as well. And I've got some collaborators at other universities that planning on working with some of those things, even like sleep deprivation. There's quite a lot of studies relating to that at the moment with altitude and cognitive function. So I've got some colleagues in that area that are going to look into something as well.
Oh, wicked. That sounds
very exciting. I don't know which trips I will be on.
Yeah. Yeah. So they run the trips and then you come in as a researcher and as a participant to, I guess, answer some of their questions, but also your own questions to help with safety in all of these high-risk environments. And obviously they can use that information to help monitor the people that they're working with to make sure that they don't have any adverse effects to their...
Exactly, it's in everyone's best interest.
So even though you don't know which one you might be going to, is there any challenge that you particularly want to do?
Well, the next one in Antarctica I really, really want to go to, and I need more money. That's my current stumbling block.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. It's pretty expensive, Antarctica. Yeah, so that's the current problem with like basically designing the study anyway. I'm considering what things we can collect without us actually being there. But obviously it is nowhere near as good, you know, the level of study, the size of the study that you can do without being there, because it's difficult to trust people to do all the things correctly. And, you know, you can't take some of the more technical measurements. It would be more of like an observational study, which is not... You know, we want to have a bit more kind of depth to the research than that. You know, we've been thinking about some kind of interventions that we could do beforehand and doing some kind of lab testing as well. You know, I work in the human performance lab at university, so I've got access to a lot of other things, including some hypoxic tents. So I've got other ideas that you can do kind of in relation to it without going there. But ultimately, you know, we want to see how some of these things happen in the situation, in an ecologically valid scenario, because that is the information that's going to inform choices and success. And like, you know, people after these, you know, you've reflected on your own experiences, and this is certainly one that I won't forget, but it changes your life. And if you have a poor experience, your life might go in a different direction. You know, the success of it isn't just for that moment, it's the quality of life in the future as well, and whether you continue to engage with these kinds of activities, what does that mean for your health, your fitness, your mental well-being, and, you know, the global kind of citizenship. You know, I really enjoy working with people from different cultures and different places and learning about those things and trying to help them be more successful. You know, tourism in Nepal is essential, and although in some ways it's kind of, I know you can discuss it in lots of different ways from a sustainability point of view and from, you know, different stresses for people that work there, but they do welcome tourism in lots of these places. So we want to try and work together with people that are there. You know, this event was supported by like different Sherpa families, solely by them. It was led by a 21-year-old. She's my friend now, Anima. She's Anima Sherpa from Kathmandu, and her dad's trekking company. And, you know, it's a business opportunity for them. So all of those things are kind of to be considered with these future events, and really want to help. You know, in Tanzania, they're considering, you know, setting up more things at the start of the kind of trek to develop the community as well. And we like use the ultrasound device to help train different people locally on different kind of techniques in medicine and science as well. So there's all of those angles to it as well, which I'm kind of excited about.
No, that's really cool. And I'm incredibly jealous. I have to ask, so when you were at Everest Base Camp, looking up at where Everest is, would you climb it?
I've been thinking about that since I was a little girl. Like, I always loved mountains, even from things like skiing. Like, I was fortunate enough to do that growing up regularly. But so I've always kind of wondered about it. And that's why I ended up doing a master's and a PhD in environmental physiology. But a lot of that was in the lab. And I just still didn't really feel like I knew what it was like. And because I've been so focused on sport and my career and things, I still don't really feel like I'm a proper adventurer. You know, I'm not a mountaineer. I don't have the high altitude climbing experience. So going to Everest Base Camp really opened my eyes to that. Like, I'm not in that field and I want to do more, but I still don't know whether I would actually try and climb Everest. Like, there are other places to climb and other places to visit. I've talked to a lot of people about it and tried to learn from things, and I'm not convinced yet. I don't know, Phil. I think I'd like to see some other ones.
Is Kalapatar the highest you've ever been?
Yeah.
Okay, so that about 5-6. So maybe a 6, then a 7,000, then finish off with an 8,000, and then the highest.
Yeah,
Everest.
And if you follow people like Adriana Brownlee, she's British. She's trying to be like the youngest person to climb all the 8,000 meter peaks. And she's doing a really advanced job of that already. Like, she's achieved so much. And I see what she's doing. I'm like, wow, that is really incredible. But I can't do it all. And so I've got too many things I want to do. So maybe down the line in my future, I'll follow that kind of mountaineering, climbing thing. And I met some people there who have different kind of insight into what climbing is. And yeah, so it's a whole other part of my life in the future, maybe. Yeah.
I can completely sympathize, like, you just wanted to get in the weeds and be in the area that you're kind of researching, especially when you're doing something like environmental physiology, because that, you know, you are so interested in the environment. That's where you got into that topic. So you kind of want to be in the environment when you're doing the research and that type of thing. And one of the main reasons I asked that question, because I remember when I was at Everest Base Camp, but I was looking up at the Khumbu Icefall, and I know how dangerous that bit is of the climb, almost like the dangerous part, and so many people have fallen at that stage. And you start to think, would you climb it? Like, many people have died in that bit that you're staring at. Would you still climb it? You still need 50 grand roughly to do it, but would you do it? And I think, oh yeah, sure, I think I would, yeah. But it's easy to sit in your armchair and think, yeah, I'd love to climb that, it'd be amazing. But when you're actually looking up at it, it's a different story, so.
Yeah, I think you have a bit more of a realistic take on it when you're stood there looking at it. Like, if you do go through the Khumbu Icefall or further, you'll be walking past bodies. Like, can I handle that? That's another thing. Like, doesn't matter whether my body can handle the altitude or not. Like, psychologically, how will I feel about that? Is it worth it? Can I just climb a different climb and I still get the challenge, physical challenge that I'm looking for, and the competition maybe that I'm looking for, and the achievement, but without having to do it in a place with a lot of kind of, I don't know, history and challenge and the impact it has on other people. Like, if you've watched Sherpa, have you seen Sherpa documentary? Yeah, it's about the avalanche in 2014 in the Khumbu Icefall, where 16 Sherpa lost their lives. And I just don't know whether I want to, I don't know. It changed my thinking. I've seen it twice now and I cry. I sound very emotional about this. I'm not really a very emotional person. But yeah, I think I tried to take more different things into consideration rather than, do I want to climb Mount Everest, which is what it used to be. It's like, yeah, I'd like the challenge. And now I consider way more things into that, which is why I'd probably choose a different climb, something that didn't have all of those other things. Of course, there's always going to be that risk, and you need a lot of experience, and you also need like, support. So, yeah, I think I just do it a different way. I think I can achieve the things I want to achieve, like the goals, and not at Everest. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to see you on your Instagram, how it all plays out over the next few years.
Yeah.
How can people find out a bit more information about this adventure company, what you're doing? And if there's people with money out there, they might be thinking, oh, I fancy a go at this. If they wanted to get involved, what do they need to do?
So World's Highest OCR is the events company, and that happens every year in different places. So that's the name of the race. It's an obstacle course race, but often it has other bits within it, say like a trek or a run. And they are really high quality events. You know, everything is provided and organized. And we were the biggest group in there. We had, you know, didn't have to carry the bags. And if, you know, the Sherpa weren't carrying the bags, the cows were, things like that. So we were really well looked after, really well organized. They give back a lot to the community. So I'm kind of like working with them. So they've got a website, they've got some videos you can watch from Everest. They've got a longer one and a shorter one if you want to see what it was like doing the OCR as well and see what it felt like to be there. So they've got kind of up until 2028, they've got events planned. So they'll be releasing them kind of progressively and different ways that you can do that. And they have like multiple events throughout the year. So yeah, lots of opportunities there. It's kind of, they worked with World Obstacle on this event as well. So like the organization of the obstacles is really kind of sophisticated too. And yeah, we've got a group, my colleagues from Dave from North Carolina, who worked on this with me as well, a sports medicine doctor, done a lot of work with the Olympic team in America as well. So yeah, there's a few people kind of involved with that. And we're really looking to get to Antarctica to do some more of this research. So there is actually sponsorship opportunities for the event itself. So if any big companies want to be seen in, you know, this really kind of challenging remote environments, if they want kind of advertisement there is an opportunity to work with World's Highest OCR and also help kind of contribute to these standards by supporting the research too. So that's what we're kind of looking for at the moment. And it's really exciting. There's a lot to be done, yeah.
Yeah, really exciting. And I'll put all that information in the show notes for anyone listening that wants to learn a little bit more. But Becky, we're going to have to get you on for a third time after your next big research/challenge, I think.
Yes,
hopefully definitely. It's Antarctica, because, you know,
I hope so
too. A little
too.
Bit different than Everest Base Camp. So yeah. So much more to talk about.
Yeah, I've got some cold research coming up as well with depression and cold water and some climate change studies and heat. So yeah, lots of things to talk about, Phil, I hope so.
Awesome. Yeah, looking forward to it already. Cool. Cheers, Becky.
Cheers.
Next week, I will be speaking to S&C coach and powerlifter Rob Palmer, who's won many national and international titles in powerlifting. And I want to know how he trains to get as strong as possible in the bench press. Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.